Welcome, listeners, to a brand new bonus episode of Oh My Word Podcast. Today, we have a very special guest. I'm very, very excited for this because today we have Aaron Rivera, who is the owner of the Frugal Frigate, which is an independent bookstore located in the Redlands in California. Aaron, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
I will say again that I'm thrilled. I'm very excited for this. Why did you decide to open a bookstore? Like, how did this even come about?
Well, I did not open the bookstore. I actually purchased it. It was an existing bookstore. We opened in 1988, and it was started by Catherine Thomerson, who was a local teacher and a professor at both Crafton Hills College and Cal State University, San Bernardino. And she taught children's literature and women's literature there. And in 1994, she gave me my first job in high school. So I worked for her at the Frugal Frigate when I was almost 16, wasn't quite 16 yet, and worked there for 4.5 years through high school and part of college. And then after college, I went into the insurance industry for about 18 years.
Oh, wow.
And I was sitting at my desk one day, and a friend texted me a screenshot of a real estate listing because the Frugal Frigate had gone on the market that morning. That was the fourth owner that had put it up for sale. And I sat there for about 5 minutes, kind of got up and paced a little bit, and just went, am I going to completely upend everything? I think I am.
Wow.
And I called the realtor and spoke to the realtor, said, look, I have no idea what I'm doing. I probably shouldn't tell you that as the realtor for the seller, but right. I have no idea what I'm doing. But I am very interested in exploring this option. And we set an appointment that evening to meet with the past owners. Had a handshake deal, entered escrow a couple of days later. And that was it. I completely changed careers.
Wow. 1988 to 1994 saw four different owners, and then you've been there since 1994?
Oh. So it opened in 98. Catherine was there. Catherine didn't sell it until about 2002, I believe.
Oh, okay.
She opened it in 1988. I worked for her for 4.5 years, left, started my career, and then she sold it in 2002. She came to my wedding in 2003.
Oh.
And then it went through three subsequent owners between Catherine and myself.
So what year did you take over the store?
2019, 8 months before a pandemic.
Oh, man. Okay, this is going to be fun. Yeah, okay. Wow. Yeah. Let's follow up on a few of those things. When you took the job in high school, was that just got to find a job or I really want to work in a bookstore?
No, it was I love to read. I love this bookstore. I had been in the bookstore several times and was thinking, yeah, I need to find a job. I'm almost 16. I wanted to get a part-time job. And it was kind of a perfect fit. And I remember talking with Jenna, who was another young lady that worked there at the time. She's about 3 years older than me, I think. I think she was in college. I was in high school and kind of talked with her on the side a little bit. And she kind of told me how to dress the part and come in. And then I came in, kind of dressed the part and talked to Catherine. And she asked me if I was a fan of Emily Dickinson, which I am. And the store is named after an Emily Dickinson poem. And so she asked me if I could recite one for her on the spot. So I did and got the job.
Well, glad you're able to do that. That would have been an awkward moment.
That was my interview.
What does it mean to dress the part? As in, what sort of language you're going to need to have available to you? Or like actual dress?
No, it was more just kind of, we had a dress code and it was no jeans. We usually wore like, plus remember this is the 90s, so
yeah.
The long flowy hippie skirt.
Yeah, okay,
like,
yeah.
I had like a crocheted vest. The funkier the better. Anyone who has ever met Catherine, they know exactly what I'm talking about.
Okay.
She was and is just so stylish and so well-dressed, but brings her own flair to it. And so in the 90s, everything was very flowy and kind of like that, so.
You never thought about, I guess, going back to a bookstore after you had worked there until it actually came up for sale?
Correct. I actually did not because the type of personality I have, I value security and stability. And I was putting up with that at a pretty high cost of mental health and stress being in the insurance industry. On paper, my career looked great. But for me, it was not good for me. I was really, really unhappy doing what I was doing. Just could not even find any pride or joy in the work that I was doing. And I tried, but just, you know, no motivation. And there had been like 2 or 3 times over my career where I kind of felt like I had come to a crossroads. I'm like, do I want to go to grad school? Do I want to, you know, what do I want to do? Because I can't keep doing this. Is this my life? Is this what I'm going to do? And each time I'd get a little too scared and like, no, I like the security. I like my 401k. I like my salary. I like the days off, you know. all these things. And so I'd always just kind of stay where I was. And I really do believe that no other opportunity probably would have come across my desk, literally, than this one that would have gotten me to make such a drastic change and make it in 5 minutes. I mean, I was pretty convinced in 5 minutes that I was going to just figure out how we were going to make this work.
Wow. And after all the years of hanging on to security and stability, right before, a couple months before a pandemic,
yeah, eight months before a global pandemic just out the window.
Well, that, yeah. Okay. Irony much. Yeah. So just because you mentioned it, that the name of the store is after, comes from an Emily Dickinson poem. So where does that, what is that? What is the name? And
it's an 8-line poem.
Okay.
It's very short, so I'll give it to you. It's, "There is no frigate like a book to take us lands away, nor any coursers like a page of prancing poetry. This traverse may the poorest take without oppressive toll. How frugal is the chariot that bears the human soul." So essentially, books are a way to travel, and you can do it inexpensively. So the frigate is the book, and frugal is the method of travel.
Ah, very good. Like, you wouldn't name a store like, not that you wouldn't name, maybe people would name a store like Cheap Books, but you're almost doing that, but just in like books are cheap, but like in a very, well, poetic kind of way.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because every now and then, I'd say maybe once a month, we have someone come in and like, "Are you a used bookstore?"
Ah,
a new bookstore. Oh, I thought with frugal in the,
right,
the name, like, no, it means inexpensive travel, not inexpensive books. Our books are the publisher list price.
Do you have the poem printed anywhere that people, like right when you walk in? Or do you have to recite it for anyone who does that?
I've got it hanging in the window. I've got it next to my little Emily Dickinson shrine in the store. It's on our bookmarks.
It's there. You cannot miss it. It is there. So speaking of that, are you selling all kinds of books? Or do you have a specific market that you're geared toward? Or what does your inventory look like?
We are specifically a children's bookstore.
Okay.
And that was how Catherine started it. And so we carry everything from babies all the way up to high school, some YA, things like that. Our biggest market is going to be middle school and under, though. That's the demographic that we sell to the most. Baby books, board books, picture books, and, middle school chapter books and graphic novels. That's really where the bulk of our sales come from. Back when Catherine had it, she opened a section called A Room of Her Own, which is kind of a play on Virginia Woolf's essay, A Room of One's Own. And we had this wonderful space. Her tagline was "For, by, and about women." And we had this wonderful space that, a girl growing up in the 90s and coming of age had access to all sorts of wonderful books and literature that really helped kind of shape a young adult coming into her own. And so we had, at the time, we were specialty children's and what she dubbed women's lit.
Okay.
And those were the two subjects that she taught in college. The second owner closed A Room of Her Own. It was 3 rooms, and he gave 2 of those rooms back to the landlord. So now those are part of our wonderful music school that we have next door. They're practice rooms. But we do still have the one back room that is currently our overstock and employee area. But I actually am looking at bringing it back. I even reached out. There's a great bookstore in Madison, Wisconsin called A Room of One's Own, named after the essay. And I just reached out to them last week and said, "Hey, here's a little bit of history. Here's who I am. And I am looking at opening up A Room of One's Own here." Now, that's not the name of our business. It's just what the room will be called within the Frugal Frigate. And it is supposed to be fiction and nonfiction for adults and, an inclusive space. So I really like going with A Room of One's Own, not A Room of Her Own, but still sticking in the spirit of Virginia Woolf's meaning, which was creating spaces for authors and readers and writers interested in women's lit. So fingers crossed, I am bringing that back this summer. It's a project I've been working on. It was something that kind of started during the pandemic, like trying to figure out how to do that, because I had wanted to do it within a year of taking over. And then with COVID hitting, that was definitely not happening, but that was just survival mode.
Yeah.
But we're looking at hopefully bringing that space back, and I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, that's great. So just to clarify, that would be like a specific section within the store that would have specifically?
It would be an entire room devoted to it, and it would be fiction, nonfiction, books on self-help, a mystery section. Like,
right.
It's not going to be huge. It's going to be very, very curated, especially to start. So we're going to have to start small,
Yep.
nice selection of curated sidelines that are literary in nature, things like that.
Right.
But what I'm hoping to do is to bring more people into the store, bring people back. You know, the book group that started back when Catherine owned the store still exists. They meet at houses, and well, pre-pandemic, they met at houses, and it's the same core group.
Wow.
In that book group for the last, you know, 30 years. So I am hoping to reach out to them and invite them back into the space once it's safe to gather in groups and kind of just bring back some of that, honestly, some of that magic that Catherine started. I know it sounds trite, but I have no other way to put it. It just really was a magical space to be in. And like I said, that's why this store, that's why now, that's the only thing that would get me out of my comfort zone.
Right. Well, I guess magic can also, or, you know, I might be interpreting this wrong, but magic is also sort of the atmosphere that you get when you're in a community bookstore and you feel like everyone's part of the same thing versus someone who's just like passing through, I guess, almost.
Absolutely. And it's funny because even people who are passing through, if they're just visiting or they're kind of tourists, or, you know, we get a big draw under normal circumstances, a big draw for the University of Redlands graduation time. A lot of people are in town. They also have the Children's Literature Festival, the Charlotte Huck Children's Literature Festival every year. And that's a big draw for people from all over. And we get people that pass through, but they actually kind of feel that community in that space. Like it's just been imbued with something, and people, they pick up on that even if they're not from here.
Well, well, the reaching out to the store, and what do you say was it Madison, Wisconsin?
A Room of One's Own in Madison, Wisconsin. It's a feminist bookstore.
Oh, so to help curate the list, kind of.
No. Uh-oh. I just wanted to let them know, like, hey, I'm going to be using the name. Okay. Kind of wanted your blessing because, you know, obviously they can't copyright that name. At least I don't believe they could copyright that name because it is a work by Virginia Woolf. So
right. Okay.
It wasn't that. It was definitely a professional courtesy. You know, I don't know if they have Google Alerts set up. I have Google Alerts set up so that if the name The Frugal Frigate appears somewhere online, I get a daily digest telling me what's being said about my store. And so I didn't want them to find out that way that someone in Southern California opened up what they don't know whether is a room or a store or what, and it's named the same thing that their bookstore is. So I did not want any surprises. That was why I reached out to them.
Yeah, well, do you have a big network between of independent bookstore, like all the independent bookstore kind of peoples, or is it just something that you sort of Googled and then reached out to them?
It's a little bit of both. We have communication means, you know, being members of the American Booksellers Association. I am part of an independent booksellers group on Facebook, and right. That's actually probably the biggest resource that I have found is booksellers just being able to ask each other questions. And, you know, we might not even know where each other are from unless we specifically say, hey, I'm, you know, from The Frugal Frigate in California. Like we just, but people will ask, they trade ideas. And it is a very, it really, once I found that group, it really made me feel like I had some support in this because I'm telling you, I was winging it when I bought this.
Yeah, wow. You didn't have time to find your feet even before everything just.
No.
Yeah, wow.
No, and I mean, I just, I bought a bookstore and I hadn't been involved with children's literature in 18 years. So actually longer than that, it was probably closer to 2022.
That's actually leads to the next thing, which how do you, so it's two parts to it. How do you actually curate, I guess, curate your inventory? How do you, and it's also about finding the balance between all the new stuff you want to bring in versus like whatever is considered a well-loved classic or well-loved classic within the community. Like, how do you have room on your shelves? I never have enough room on the shelves. But how do you
that
balance
is
that?
The challenge.
Yeah.
Having the room on the shelves is the challenge. And I have definitely struggled with that, but in good ways. Like, I mean, what a good problem to have. Like,
yeah.
Oh, there's so many books and not enough space. So it's definitely, it's a fun challenge. And for me, and I can't say that this would work for everyone, especially if others are starting a bookstore and have actually, there's the thing called Bookstore Bootcamp that I just found out about,
timing.
Over a year and a half into owning this, I just found out about Bookstore Bootcamp. And so I'm debating on still maybe attending that after the, you know, when it's safer to travel and gather in groups. But for me, I just said, all right, look, when I was a kid, what did I want to see on the shelf? And now that I'm an adult and have sort of evolved from, you know, being raised in second wave feminism, moving on to third wave feminism of intersectionality, what do I want to put on my shelves? What do I want to project to the community? And what I want is for any child to come in and hopefully be able to look on the shelf and see themselves represented in a book. For me, it was looking for diversity. It was looking for stories that maybe don't normally get, you know, face out shelf time, but that's not anything pioneering in the book industry by any means. There are so many booksellers doing that, and that really is kind of the environment that I have found in the booksellers group, is that this is the mentality of is inclusion and diversity and intersectionality and having hard conversations and making sure that children feel loved and accepted no matter what and things like that. And so that was how I kind of set out my framework of what do I want to put in the store.
And then where are you finding, are these books because you're getting publisher catalogs or you're looking for recommendations either from reviews or how do you choose or find the books that you're looking for?
All of the above.
Okay.
All of the above. I have some really great publisher reps that I've developed relationships with over the last year and a half.
Okay.
And that was kind of a tough nut to crack because I really had no idea how that worked. I wasn't sure, you know, what they were there to do and what they weren't there to do.
Okay.
And so, but when you find a good rep at a publisher, like they are just instrumental in helping you curate your list. And they, you know, once a quarter, I will be on the phone with a handful of my reps. We'll be on the phone for maybe 2 hours and we're just going through all the front list titles and they know them front and back. Like they understand what the product is that they're selling because that's their job. And so they will tell me, here's what this book is about. Here's who this author is. Here's why they wrote this book. Here's, you know, and the illustrations kind of look like, you know, this, this, and this. And so you get this picture in your head and it is old fashioned on the phone sales.
Wow.
Which I have found as someone who is, you know, like, I guess I'm an exennial. I'm not a millennial. I am like on the end of Gen X, like, you know, grew up with no cell phones and coming home when streetlights came on.
Yeah.
I still really respect that one-on-one contact on the phone, even though it can be time consuming and finding someone that's willing to do that is difficult. But that I found has been really, really great. It's just that conversation with a one-on-one with a rep that knows their stuff, knows their product, knows you and knows what you're looking for.
Yeah.
They're not going to try and sell you something that they don't think you want on your shelf or that they don't think you can sell.
Right.
Because that doesn't do them any good either. So it is something that, which also part of my personality, aside from the liking to play it safe, is not asking for help.
Huh.
I'm not the kind of person that really would ask for help. I'm the kind of person people will go to for help.
Uh-huh.
And so kind of getting out of that comfort zone too and asking for help when I need it and asking someone like, I have no idea what I'm doing. Can you please walk me through this list on Edelweiss? Because I don't know how to use Edelweiss. And I still don't use Edelweiss.
Yeah.
I used to look at the book catalogs, but I have yet to place an order on it because there's only so many hours in the day.
Right.
And, you know, there's so much to learn. So I have learned to take help wherever it is being offered, whether that's a sales rep or a bookstagrammer who I find on Instagram that I think, oh, hey, they curate a great selection of books. I'm going to follow them or I'm going to set up notifications when they make a post. So I see what they're talking about.
Right.
Yeah. So it really is just, it's a lot of digging and sifting. It almost is like when you go into a great giant used bookstore, like the last bookstore in LA or something, and you can spend hours just looking for treasures. That's kind of how it is to curate books.
Oh, wow. You said that you're on the phone every quarter to put in a new order. So that's every couple of months you're changing
the inventory? To talk about front list titles. So front list titles, meaning things that are coming out that aren't out yet. So they'll, you know, we'll talk in the winter for the spring or sometimes even we'll work ahead into the summer titles of here's what's coming out. I place my order and then they ship as they are getting released. So it's kind of a slow and steady influx of brand new titles.
Okay.
But maintaining the inventory in the store is all through Ingram. I mean, I just use Ingram to stock the store. We usually get 2 to 3 shipments a week.
Oh, wow.
Which is why we can do special orders and turn them around very quickly. You know, if they're in our West Coast warehouse, we'll have your book within 3 days.
So anyone could come and order any book through you, even though you specifically have the children's market.
Absolutely. We do it all the time.
Well, that's good for everyone to know. Everyone hear that?
Yeah. Even on our website, you can search. Our website is tied to Ingram's database. So you can go on there and search for whatever you're looking for, and you can still order it through us.
Ah, very good. So, well, does it ever come to a point where, I don't know if it's a conscious thing or not, that there's a certain book that you're just not ordering anymore, even after it's sold out, even after you're done with your inventory of it? Like, how do you decide that?
Sure.
Yeah.
It's, you know, if I've had a title that's been, you know, on its little display rack for a handful of months, and, you know, it was selling like crazy in the beginning, but now we've just had those last two copies that are sitting there, and they're sitting there, and sitting there, and it's been a month or two. Usually what I do is I will take those, I'll shelf them spine out. We do, because we do have, you know, we have display face out and we have spine out. And that's an interesting thing that was different between the 90s and now, is that if it's not face out, it really doesn't sell unless they are specifically looking for it.
Oh, wow.
I can tell you about that in a second. But, yeah. You know, to encourage turnover and fresh new titles in the store, that's really how it works. And so the last one or two that just maybe aren't moving, you know, somebody's going to come in the next 6 months and say, hey, do you have this? It came out last year. Yeah, yeah. I do. It's just not on display anymore because there's something new in its place. But so that's kind of how I decide. Like, if it just kind of slows down, okay, well, that one needs to get shelved, and now it's made room for something new.
So what was this, the spine out versus the shelf out, you said?
Yeah, so face out, you know, in this modern age of online shopping, in the last 10 years or so, we've gotten used to seeing the face of a book, the cover of a book.
Yeah.
Not looking in the mystery section, if that's your thing, you know, or looking in the science fiction section, if that's your thing, and saying, oh, I like this author, maybe there's something new over here, or, you know, I'm going to go browse, like, oh, this title is grabbing me. No, is the cover grabbing you? Because the cover is what grabs people now. So
absolutely.
Because we're so used to scrolling through online shopping and seeing a product face out,
mm-hmm.
that's had to translate into retail as well. So books that are face out will sell so much faster than books that are spine out.
That actually makes sense, because I do judge a book by its cover. Even though...
I do too. Yeah. I absolutely judge a book by its cover.
Yeah.
100%.
Right. Like, I know you're not supposed to do that, but a catchy cover is going to catch my interest. I will look at it.
Yep.
Even though... Yeah. I do like still browsing by spine, and I wish sometimes that bookstores online would have the spine thing, because sometimes I do look at within the vicinity, but definitely cover is definitely...
Yeah. They grab you. If your cover art is... And that's what's so... great about it, though, is that it's so subjective, because to me covers are art.
Yeah.
And art is subjective to everybody, so what I love you might not, and you know, there's no one right or wrong way to market a book.
Right.
It really is just who's going to walk in the door,
right,
and what's going to appeal to them.
Well,
found if you love it, others will listen to you talk about it, and if you talk about something that you love, hand selling a book that way is so fun.
Well, yeah, you get to talk about a book. Do most people are coming into the store, well, I don't know if you have a number for this, are a lot of them looking for recommendations, or most people are coming in knowing what they want, maybe willing to listen to recommendation?
Oh, I'd say at least 50% of the people coming in are looking for recommendations.
Wow.
You know, the unfortunate reality is that if you know what you want, you're going to go online and get it. Why would you go to a brick and mortar store? Other than it being, you know, a super community oriented person that really wants to support small business and actually thinks about that. Like,
right.
You know, and zero shade to anybody who shops online. Like, I shop online too.
But,
you know, sometimes you just can't bring yourself to leave the house, especially in a pandemic. That completely changed the face of everything. But even before that, if you know what you want and you know where to get it, why would you get in the car? Drive downtown. Try to find parking to come in and pay list price for a book.
Right.
So we do a lot of recommendations. We have a lot of people that come in and say, I need a book for a 4-year-old turning 5. He likes... this, this, and this. What do you got? Like, that happens every single day.
Great. How many of these books do you actually have to read, try to read, or whatever, versus just knowing a lot about the book? Because,
I mean,
you can't read everything.
To read excerpts and portions of as many as I can. If I read cover to cover, I usually do it pretty quickly. It's going to be something that just grabbed me from the first chapter, and I don't want to put it down. Usually, if I read something cover to cover, I read it cover to cover in a couple of days. Stay up way too late doing it.
Yeah, amen. Yeah. Well, that's the good thing about the kids, at least dealing with kids' books, is that you're not reading, you know, 500-page. I mean, it doesn't mean you have more time for reading, but you're not reading 500-page books, at least. So.
Right. Yeah. Like, yeah. You can't. There's just too many new ones. So I try to either read, like, the first chapter, or I try to dive. I do that terrible thing where you dive right in the middle of the book, because even if I don't know what's going on, I see what the language is like. I see what the rhythm is like. You know, do I like the dialogue? Do I like how the characters are playing off of each other? Do I like the narrative that's going on? And then I will research it and read the publisher's marketing that they've put out about what the book is about and who it's recommended for, and, you know, a little bit about the authors and things like that. And so that in that way, that's kind of how I stay up on what's new and am able to make recommendations to people. And the other cool thing is, if you make that recommendation and you're honest with them, like, I haven't read it. What I read is chapter 1, and I loved it, and here's what it's about. I don't know how it ends, so I can't tell you like if there's any trigger warnings on this or not, but right. here's what it's about. Here's right. the subject matter. And if you love it, please message me or come back and tell me. Mm-hmm. Because if you love it, then I can tell someone else, like, I had a customer that loved this and here's why.
Right.
Again, it's asking for help.
That's true. Do you ever look at people's book, at other customer book reviews, or you're looking mainly at the publisher stuff and just whatever you pick up from having read it?
I get customer reviews in person. So people love to tell me about what they've been reading and why they liked it.
Right.
And so I use that all the time. Especially if they're like, oh God, my son, you know, he's in second grade. He doesn't want to read, but he just loved this series. If it's not something I have in the store, you better believe I'll have it next week.
Yeah.
Because that's the kind of information I need. That's that on the ground demographic information I need, that there is a real child out there in my town that doesn't like to read, but he tore through this entire series because he found something he loved. And that's the trick of trying to help reluctant readers, because we get those every day too.
Yeah.
Parents coming in that are like, they've got to read for their AR points and they hate reading and they only want to read graphic novels. It's like, well, that's okay, but graphic novels can get expensive. So now that the libraries are reopened, get them 10 graphic novels. They're only going to get 10 AR points for it, but then maybe get them into this because this ties into this graphic novel over here that they like and it's worth 6 points. So getting reluctant readers in every single day, it's just finding that right thing. And you have to have the conversations with the kids. And you have to ask them, like, what do you like? Tell me the last book that you did like. Mm-hmm. I don't care what it was. What was it?
Yeah.
Okay. And then you find something that kind of plays off of that, whether it's a theme or the type of character or, you know, it was an animal story or it was spooky or something. Just find some little nugget in whatever it is that they're talking about that they seem excited about, and then translate that to something else. And they usually will try something else. And 9 times out of 10, we're pretty successful in them coming back and saying, do you have book two?
Oh, wow. That's great.
It's fun. It's so fun.
Yeah. Well, this is probably a little redundant, but I guess that's kind of what you're training. If anybody's an employee for you, it'd be that same mm-hmm. thing of like, make sure you're talking to the customers, not just to find out what they want, but what they've liked, and use that information to your benefit.
Yeah. And I only have 2 employees right now, 2 part-time employees. They're both college students, but they're both avid readers and they both have their, you know, their favorite genres, and they're both different, which is great because so between the two of them, like, even if I'm not there, like, they're very good at curating something for someone that comes in. I'm very proud of them for that.
Yeah, good job. Did you have them recite a Dickinson poem for you when they came in?
I did not.
Oh.
You know what I have noticed? Poetry is not as popular as it was when I was in school. And I'm not that poetry was popular in high school in the 90s, but there were more of us reading it. I don't know if it's being taught as much or what, but it breaks my heart. And I try to get people into poetry because it was so important to me. But no, I don't think I could ask the average kid today to recite a poem for me.
Actually, speaking about how things have changed, was the whole online system, especially with online ordering, which I guess must be a lot of your orders today, was that already set up for you, or did you have to, you know, by previous owners, or you had to set that all up when you came in?
So you have to set up your own accounts because it's your own credit that's
right.
on the line there. When I bought the store, the reason the last owner sold it was she started another business and it got very successful and she could not do both. And she had her son managing the bookstore while she was running her new store, which is not a bookstore by any means. She was making like bath bombs and soaps and like beauty products, and her stuff's amazing. It's called Principle and it's amazing. And it's 2 blocks down from where the bookstore is. Yeah. Anyway, so her son was managing the store for her, and he very graciously kind of trained me for a month. Like, when I gave my notice at my job and went, while we were in escrow, I was coming into the store. And, you know, on one hand, you got some free labor from me.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, like, you're showing me the day-to-day operations of kind of how this goes and answering questions and helping me with learning the point of sale software and just kind of learning the basics of being a bookseller and what I could get a crash course in 30 days, basically. You know, he didn't have to do that, but they want me to be successful. They want, the last owner saved it after the 2008 recession hit.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the store was a few months from probably closing their doors because of what happened in 2008. And so they bought it and turned it around. And I owe them everything for keeping that store there so that I could have it now.
Yeah.
'Cause it wouldn't be there if Gay hadn't bought it and turned it around. Well, so they very much have a vested interest in seeing me succeed because of just the legacy that this store has. You know, this is going to be our 33rd year.
Amazing.
And it is a loved fixture in the community. And I will say that that was a huge, you know, I didn't start from square one here. I started in an institution in this town that people grew up in and know and love and want to support. So, you know, it's had its ups and downs with the economy, as all businesses do, but I definitely had a leg up and a lot of support in doing this.
That's great. That's incredible. It's very off the cuff a little bit question. Is there anything, like one thing they say a lot of people don't expect that booksellers have to take care of X, or something they wouldn't expect being a bookseller means doing X? Is there anything that you could off the top of your head?
Specific to bookselling or small business ownership?
Well, you can answer it, Trevor, right? But bookselling would be better, but if you want to do it as a small business owner, that's fine. Yeah.
No, let's see. Small, as a bookseller, I think that people don't understand just how unautomated this is, that this really is a person looking at book catalogs, looking at book lists, and weighing a lot of things. And, you know, we all have our personal filters that we just look at the world through.
Yeah.
And so all of this information is just kind of getting filtered through my brain and my personal filters and trying to make decisions on what to put in the store and how many to order. And is this going to be a gamble? Probably. But do you want to take that gamble? Yeah, I want to stand for that kind of a thing. And it is so personal. And I think that maybe that isn't what is common knowledge as a bookseller, is when you're talking to somebody who owns a bookstore, they've touched everything in that store. They have chosen it. They have chosen it for a reason. And, you know, it could be a profound reason and it could be a really, really simple reason, you know?
Right.
Maybe they were feeling extra generous and somebody walked in off the street and said, hey, I wrote this book. Will you sell it? I'm like, yeah, I'll take 4 copies.
Well, that's actually a very good answer. Because Amazon, you just find anything you want there. So you're not just automatically putting every book in your store. So that is very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. Is there any one book that you can think of off the top of your head that's been around, like, for hundreds, okay, not hundreds of years, I'm exaggerating, but, like, people are just always, there's always someone asking for this book. Are there any books that are like that?
Off the top of my head, Good Night Moon, but, you know, everybody knows Good Night Moon. That one will always sell. Where the Wild Things Are is still a bestseller. You know, anything by Shel Silverstein.
That's poetry, yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's fun poetry. And that's the thing, is if you can get the kids in when it's funny and fun, then it's like a gateway into the more serious stuff.
Right.
I know there's so many, you know, English teachers that try. And I think that for teachers, when they can even get one student to kind of spark on something that they're passionate about, like, that's what makes teaching worthwhile and rewarding for them. And I know that I had a lot of good teachers, but I had some very specific ones. One that made me love Shakespeare, and that is not an easy thing to do.
Nope.
You know, and one that made me love poetry.
Amazing. Not because I want to wrap up, there's so much interesting things to talk about, but just because I'm looking at the time. We always end off with the fill in the blank of, I love it when you can use either writers, publishers, books, series, cover, whatever you want, do X. And I really don't like it when they do X. Either connected or not, but how would you fill in the blank for either of those?
I could make them definitely interconnected. And I will say that it is on a self-published side.
Okay.
I have a soapbox about that. And okay. I love it when a self-published author contacts me, introduces themselves, says, hey, I wrote this book. Here's what it's about. Would you maybe be interested in taking a look at it? The answer is going to be yes. If it's something that fits my demographic in the store, then right. I absolutely would love to take a look at. Wow. What is difficult is when someone walks in point blank. I may be in the store. I may not. I may be busy. I may be working on something. And my employee, you know, one of my college students at the front counter, and they walk in and they want you to look at their stuff right there. And that is pretty much the fastest way to get me to say thanks, but no thanks. Because I need time to sit with it. I need time to look at it. I need time to research it. And I will say that doesn't happen often. That does not happen often. I have found that self-published authors, by and large, are they're humble. They're respectful. They are open to feedback. They want to know what you think of their book. And they really want to know. It's not like, well, yeah, if I could get your opinion on this, and then, you know, do you really want it? Because it might be constructive criticism. But yeah. I have never had a bad conversation with an aspiring author. And I also have to put out there to them, like, just so you know, I am by no means an expert in this at all. Like, I've been doing this for less than 2 years. Yes, I did it in high school and college, but that doesn't mean that I know what I'm talking about. I can only tell you what I have observed, what I have seen as to what sells and what doesn't, and the small amounts of information that I have gleaned from the publishing industry and the publishing side of things of, like, what is going to potentially make you successful or not. But take that with a huge grain of salt.
Right. It's a very specific experience.
It is. It is a very specific experience. And it's very nuanced as well. And I think one of my favorite conversations that I ever had with an aspiring author is she brought in three samples of books. And it was three different samples from three different self-publishing avenues. And you just subtle differences between them. And I was able to say, okay, well, with this one, because I was like, well, which one do you like the best? And she's like, well, I like this one the best. And I said, okay, I'm going to tell you why I think that this one next to it is better, because this one has a glossy cover, and this glossy cover does not photograph well. And so when you are promoting your book and you're going to bookstores and you're doing story times and you're taking pictures with kids that are, you know, getting their book signed by an author, and they hold the book up, you're going to get a glare. They're going to not hold it at the precise right angle to actually show the cover of the book. And then that, you know, where's, you're trying to market yourself.
Very good.
Like, so I would go with this matte finish because it will photograph from any angle. So people can tag you in it. People can see your book cover. You want it in front of people's faces because, like I said, if it's not faced out, it probably won't sell.
Yep. Very good. Oh, look at that. We came full circle.
So just like a tiny piece of information that I have noticed with books. And I've noticed that because I photograph books in my store. I make displays, and I'm trying to be active on Instagram, Facebook, and things like that. And it is really difficult sometimes depending on the materials used. And I wouldn't have known that. And that is only a very small piece of advice that I can give, but it's something that I feel confident in giving because I found it out on my own.
That's also significant. That's like an important, it might be small, but it's important. So very good. Well, Erin, thank you so much. I appreciate your time, and I'm so glad we got to speak with you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. And I also, at the end, can I just give a shout out to two people?
Yes.
That would be my husband, who I text 5 minutes after I decided, or after I got the text about the bookstore, and I said, the Frugal Frigate's for sale. And he texted back and said, I guess we're buying a bookstore.
Yay! I applaud him, yes.
And also to my mother, Karen, because she was my first phone call after I found out about this. And I was shaking and, like, doing that almost crying, excited voice thing. And she couldn't understand what I was saying. And then I finally got it out that the Frugal Frigate was for sale. And I don't know how I'm going to buy it. And she said, well, the house is almost paid off. I'll take a mortgage out if you want. And my mother gave me a very large chunk, more than half of the purchase price, far more than half.
Wow. You have good people in your life.
I really, really do. I could not do this without both of them. And they have both been so incredibly supportive and also have let me steer this ship. So they have been my supporters, but they have let me do this how I want to do it. And I am so grateful for that. And thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was an absolute pleasure. This was a bonus episode of Oh My Word podcast featuring bookstore owner Erin Rivera of The Frugal Frigate. To find out more about Erin and her store, please visit the link in the episode notes. To find out more about Oh My Word podcast and all the great stuff we're up to, follow us on Instagram at Oh My Word podcast and check us out at eltenenbaum.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Catch you next time.